about the insufferability of quintic polynomials.
I was testing the sound, and I argue with you about the very honor.
Sure. Things worked, so it should be a great book from now on. And I'm handing to the professor. Thank you.
Okay. So, let me mess up before anything, okay? So, you know, how many of you have heard this sort of story about Galois writing a letter to his friend on the last night of his life before a duel and revealing the proof that nobody can solve the quintic equation? And I'm sure you've... Well, I heard it when I was little, and it was one of my... It was one of the highlights of my undergraduate studies when I learned in second year, towards the end of the second year, how to prove this Galois theorem using that you cannot solve equations of degree 5 using so-called Galois theory, which involves field extensions and automorphisms groups and the fact that the permutation groups or the alternating groups are solvable and various complicated things. And it's so complicated that I never got the sense that I really understood why the theorem is true. And just a few years ago, I finally learned why the theorem is true, and I want to share it with you. And it's true for reasons that anybody can understand without having to take all of this Galois theory complicated stuff. The Galois theory complicated stuff is useful, but for other things. Okay? There still are prerequisites for this. And the main prerequisite is you need to... Well, it helps if you've heard the word group before, though it's not absolutely necessary. And you definitely need to know the complex numbers and the fact that how many roots every complex number has. So if you're looking at the fifth roots of a complex number, there are exactly 5 of them. And they are, you know, if you know one of them, you know the rest. So, you know, if you know that z to the... Sorry, is this readable or should I use a darker... maybe darker will be better. So, if you want to find the roots of z to the 5 is equal to c, so in other words, you want to find the fifth roots of c, then there are 5 of them. And if the first one is here, happens to be this number, then the others are obtained by rotating by 1/5 of a rotation in the complex plane 5 times. So the next one would be here, 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 and they would form a nice pentagon. Okay, so that's all you need to know. Okay? Good. My talk follows a handout, and I hope you all have a copy. Well, I hope many of you have a copy. And I should say that and here's sort of the key notions that appears in the talk. The key notion is the commutator of two operations. So if you have two operations A and B, or you know, if you're fancy and you know the world of groups, then you would say two group elements A and B, then the commutator of A and B is denoted by A bracket B, and it's equal to A, B, A inverse, B inverse, which really means do A, then do B, then undo A, then undo B. Okay? Now, if for certain operations, if you do A and then you do B, and then you undo A and then you undo B, you get back where you started. But that's not always the case. So an example where it is the case is the natural numbers, and I will think of a number m as the operation of adding m. So in the natural numbers, adding m, adding n, then subtracting m, then subtracting n, does nothing. And I think it's called the commutative law. At least in Kanda it's called the commutative law, I don't know. So, for example, if you do 2017 and add to it 729, which I believe is today's date, no, today's 829, I got it wrong. Sorry, minus 2017 minus 729, you get zero, and luckily I'm in front of a computer so I can check it, so let me hit enter, and the computer says that it really is zero. But there are other operations that don't behave like that. So for example, if you stand somewhere on planet Earth and go 500 miles north, and then 500 miles west, and then 500 miles south, and then 500 miles east, you don't come back where you started. Okay? And I think I want to give one of the simplest examples of places where the commutator isn't the identity, doesn't come back where you start, okay? And this is the example of a permutation groups. So the permutation group, sorry, now I need an eraser here. The permutation group Sn is the set of all bijections, so one-to-one and on-to maps, from the set of integers 1, 2, 3, 4 up to n back to itself, so 1, 2, 3, 4 up to n. And a permutation is a bijection from this set to itself. So in other words, it would be a map that maps 2 to 4, 4 to 3, 3 to n, n to 2, and so on, so that it's 1 to 1 and on to, in other words, so that it's reversible, in other words, so that an arc like that, a line like that, starts from every integer, an arrow starts at every integer, and an arrow, and one arrow ends at every integer. Now, there is a standard notation for permutation, so this is a bit cumbersome, and a standard notation for permutation is the cycle notation. So if I write 2, 3, 5 inside parentheses, what it means is the permutation that maps 2 to 3, 3 to 5, 5 back to 2, and doesn't touch all the other numbers. So that would correspond to the permutation 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 2 goes to 3, 3 goes to 5, 5 goes to 2, and 1 and 4 are untouched. Okay? So here is an example where a commutator is equal to the identity. Is not equal to the identity. So in the permutation group of three letters, of the numbers from 1 to 3, I claim that the commutator of the cycle 1, 2, which just means 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 1, and 3 is untouched, with the permutation, the cyclic permutation 2, 3, which means 2 goes to 3, 3 goes to 2, and 1 is untouched, I claim that this commutator is the permutation 1, 2, 3, which means 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 3, and 3 goes to 1. If you don't believe me, let's test. Let's check it. So I compose from left to right. Okay? So when I say AB is equal to AB, A inverse, B inverse, I mean read from left to right. First do A, then do B, then do A inverse, then do B inverse. So so the commutator of 1, 2, and 2, 3 is 1, 2, 2, 3, 1, 2 inverse, which happens to be itself, because all that 1, 2 does is to swap 1 and 2. The inverse is to swap them back again. And then 2, 3 inverse. So let's see what happens if I feed 1 into this permutation. So 1 goes to 2 by the first step. Then by the second step, 2 goes to 3. By the third step, 3 is untouched. And by the fourth step, 3 goes to 2. So overall, 1 went to 2, which is exactly what I wrote on the right. Where does 2 go? So 2 goes to 1, then it is untouched. 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 3, so 2 overall went to 3, which is what I wrote here. And finally, where does 3 go? 3 is untouched, then it goes to 2, then it goes to 1, then it's untouched, so 3 went to 1, and that's what you get. Okay? So is the notion of a commutator clear? It shouldn't be clear how it's related to solving equations. This is still background. Okay? Now, example 2. In a permutation group in which there are at least 4 elements, in which the number the integers run from 1 to at least 4, possibly more, the commutator of the cycle ijk with the cycle jkl, where ij and k and l are any 4 integers, and since there are 4 indices appearing here, I needed n to be at least 4. So I claim that this commutator is the product of il with jk. So let's check it. So where does I go under this? So I goes to j, j goes to k, k goes backwards to j, j goes backwards, so it goes to l. So overall, I went to l, which is as claimed on the right. And you can check all the others. I think you got the point, right? I'm wasting your time, basically. Okay. Next example. In a permutation group of order at least 5, ijk with klm, so the commutator of 2 cycles that intersect at 1 index. Here the intersection is k. So ij and k and kl and m, I claim, is the cycle jkm. Should we test it, or am I wasting your time?
Let's keep going.
What?
Let's keep going.
Keep going. Okay. No, but that's the key point. That's the perhaps the most important point of the talk. So, let's check just where j goes. So j should go to k according to the assertion on the right-hand side. So on the left-hand side, j goes to k goes to l stays put, and then l goes backward to k, which is what I've asserted. Okay. But you see, this means that you can write any cycle of length 3 as the commutator of 2 cycles of length 3. Because you could set j, k, and m to be whichever numbers you want, and then then you'd have to decide what to put for I and L. So just put them whatever you want, whatever you want them to be, other than J, K, and M. So for example, if I wanted to write 1, 2, 3 as a commutator of 2 permutations of 2 cycles, I would set J to be 1, K to be 2, M to be 3, and then I and L to be 4 and 5 in some order. I don't know in which order I chose here. And then the conclusion would be that the commutator of 1, 2, 3, sorry, that the permutation, the cycle 1, 2, 3 is the commutator of 4, 1, 2 with 2, 5, 3. But you see, each of these is a cycle of length 3. So I could write each of these as a commutator of 2 cycles. So 1, 2, 3 is the commutator of the commutator of 3, 4, 1 with 5, 1, 5, 2, and the commutator of 1, 2, 5 and 3, and 5, 4, 3. But now I could iterate. Each of these 4 cycles could itself be written as the commutator of 2 cycles. So 1, 2, 3 is also equal to this horrible commutator of commutators of commutators. But then I could go on, and 1, 2, 3 is also equal to this iterated 4-step commutator of 16 different, not different, at some point there will be repetition, of 16 3 cycles written down here. Are you with me still? Okay, if you're still with me, it's excellent because this is the end of the background material, and we should start with the actual material, and I should put my clock here so that I'll know when I'm running over time. Okay, so theorem, the quintic equation, ax to the 5 plus bx to the 4 plus cx cubed and so on, does not have, you cannot find a formula to solve this equation. Where what I mean by formula is some combination of the operation, in fact, all the operations you have on your calculators, on scientific calculators. But let's restrict our attention at this point to plus, minus, times, divide, and taking n roots. And the history is that it was first solved by Abel and Galois in the 1800s, and the Galois solution is this very romantic story. I guess romantic when you look at it backwards, when you look back in time. And the solution that I'm going to present is from the 60s, so it's very hard to find the original write-up. A few other write-ups are here, and in fact, I learned this solution from a YouTube video made by a former student of mine, and it was a revelation for me when I learned it. Okay. Example. Well, we do know how to solve the quadratic equation. So, how do you solve the quadratic equation ax squared plus bx plus c? Well, there is a monster formula that maybe people remember, but how does it go? Minus b plus or minus square root of b squared minus 4ac, all of that divided by 2a. Does everybody remember that? Okay, here's a different way of saying the same. So you set delta to be b squared minus 4ac, that's the stuff under the square root sign. Then you set lowercase delta to be the square root of uppercase delta. And then the solution is r, meaning the result, is minus b plus delta divided by 2a. And by the way, since we have a computer and it's actually running a computer algebra system right now, I could just hit enter and it would tell us that this simplifies to what you already know. But here's a way of visualizing it. So I have here, I hope you can see. I mean, if you can see, you'll have to use your imagination. You probably can see, the font is probably too small to see, that this says A, this says B, this says C. Here is delta, here is lowercase delta, and here is a dot which just stands for R. Uppercase delta is b squared minus 4ac, lowercase delta is square root of delta, and r is minus b plus delta over 2a. And as I move a, b, and c in the complex plane, uppercase delta will move in the complex plane, lowercase delta will move in the complex plane, and so on. So let's see that. Maybe I can enlarge it a bit. Sorry. No, it's I think we're fine. Okay? Maybe it's a bit. So you see, if I move C, then delta moves within the complex plane, except sort of it moves out of range at some point, so the unit square shrinks. But really, it moves, delta moves. Lowercase delta moves like the square root of uppercase delta. And finally, the solution moves too. Okay? But how do I know that this is the solution? I know that by going to the next page. So here is the same thing. But now I do the following. First of all, I start from two roots, lambda 1 and lambda 2. Lambda 1 and lambda 2 will be the roots of a quadratic equation. How do I make a quadratic equation whose roots are lambda 1 and lambda 2? I look at the equation. I look at the polynomial x minus lambda 1 times x minus lambda 2 and expand it, and then I get something of the form ax squared plus bx plus c, where in fact a is just the coefficient of x squared, so it's just 1, so a is here, and b and c are move around if I move lambda 1 and lambda 2 around. And then I fit it into the previous machine. So I feed these A, B, S, C, and C into the previous machine, compute uppercase delta, then compute lowercase delta, then compute R. And you see, R here is pointing where lambda 1 is sitting, which means we found, we recovered the solution by the machine. Okay? So, in fact, if I move lambda 2 here, nothing will change. Sorry. A, B, and C will move, uppercase delta will move, lowercase delta will move, R will not change because R is pointing at lambda 1, and by continuity it will continue pointing at lambda 1. But if on the other hand I point at lambda 1 and move it, then R moves in exactly the same way, which means that we solved the quadratic equation. Are you with me? Good. So let's move on and solve the cubic equation. I wanted to tell you about roots, square root, and square roots and persistent square roots. So what are square roots? You know what square roots are. I have to explain what are persistent square roots. So persistent square roots are, you know, the problem with the square root function is that you have to, if you want to turn it into a continuous function, you can't, right? There are always two choices for the square root, and you cannot consistently make the choice continuously on the whole complex plane. So for example, if I look at this, you can see the target there, which is really the input for the square root function, then the dot here move like it's square root, and its square root at some point will jump. So you know, if I take the square root of I, the square root of I is a number with angular part 45 degrees, so it's over there, and that makes sense. And if I'll keep moving towards minus 1, the square root of minus 1 will move towards I. But if I'll move past minus 1 to numbers with a negative imaginary part, I will have to jump with the square root to negative I. Okay, there isn't a continuous way to choose the square root function. However, if you sort of allow yourself to look back at history, you can make it continuous. In other words, my algorithm for giving an answer for what the square root of a number is, I'll assume that you're asking me sort of a continuous set of questions. So you're asking me, what's the square root of a number? Then you're asking me, what's the square root of a neighboring number? Then you're asking me, what's the square root of a number neighboring to that? And the way I will answer is I will always give the answer which is correct and close to the answer that I gave before. Okay? So, and that's the persistent square root. Here is the number 1, and the persistent square root of the number 1 is the number 1. When I move the square root, the input, towards I, the persistent square root moves towards the number with angular part 45 degrees. When the input moves to minus I, to minus 1, the persistent square root goes to I. And now, when I continue moving, I will say to myself, okay, when I continue moving, I could either give the answer which is above, or the answer which is opposite to it, it's negative right below, and the one I will choose to give is the one close to the answer I gave before. So as I move the input, the output moves continuously. Okay? So, by the way, the persistent square root has the funny property that, you know, if I compute the square root of minus 1, the answer will depend which previous answers I gave. So, if I go to minus 1 from above, the output will be plus I. But If I go to minus 1 from below, if I'll ask a sequence of questions, which means going to minus 1 from below, the answer will be minus 1. And, sorry, am I running out of time?
No.
Oh, okay. And, you know, the this sort of reminds me of an unrelated story, and I'll tell you the unrelated story if, depending on how much time I have.
No, my legs is numb.
What?
My legs is numb from sitting.
All right, okay. So, you know, there is this classic British TV series, Yes, Prime Minister, in which the civil servant is basically puppeteering the minister, okay? And at some point, the civil servant is trying to explain to the minister how you can poll a population and get completely opposite answers on a given question by asking preliminary questions that lead in different directions. So, I mean, the text is here, it's also on the back of your handout, but let's see the original.
Well, that happens. Nice young lady comes up to you. Obviously, you want to create a good impression, you don't want to look a fool, do you?
No.
So she starts asking you some questions. Mr. Willing, are you worried about the number of young people without jobs?
Yes.
Are you worried about the rise in crime among teenagers?
Yes.
Do you think there's a lack of discipline in our comprehensive schools?
Yes.
Do you think young people welcome some authority and leadership in their lives?
Yes.
Do you think they respond to a challenge?
Yes.
Would you be in favor of reintroducing national service?
Yes. Well, I suppose I might.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Of course you would, Bernard. After all you've told you, can't say no to that. So, they don't mention the first 5 questions, they promise to ask one.
Is that really what they do?
Well, not the reputable ones, no, but there aren't many of those. So, alternatively, the young lady can get the opposite result.
How?
Mr. Woolley, are you worried about the danger of war?
Yes.
Are you worried about the growth of arms?
Yes.
Do you think there's a danger in giving young people guns and teaching them how to kill?
Yes.
Do you think it's wrong to force people to take up arms against their will?
Yes.
Would you oppose the reintroduction of national service?
Yes.
Well, you see, Bernard, the perfect balanced sample. So, we just commission our own survey.
Okay. So now I told you about persistent square root, and I can move on to tell you about the cubic equation. Everybody knows how to solve the cubic equation. You just have to realize these formulas. And these formulas are the good way to do it. So the inputs are A, B, C, D. You compute uppercase delta by these very simple and memorable things, and lower delta, then uppercase gamma, then lowercase gamma by taking a cubic root, and then the solution R is this simple formula coming from this input. And if you really want to know what this looks like, again, we have a computer algebra system in that what it comes out to be. But it really means a relatively simple machine. Here is the machine. Here are the inputs, A, B, and C. When you move A, B, C as you please, uppercase delta moves, and as a result, lowercase delta moves, and as a result, uppercase gamma moves, and as a result, lowercase gamma moves, and as a result, R moves. Here is R over here. I really hope you can see. I'm afraid the quality of the, the resolution perhaps is not enough. But anyway, what? Where is R?
R's on the right.
Oh, it's stuck far away. It's stuck on the edge. So instead of R moving, the unit square has to rescale. Anyway, but of course you have no reason to believe me, so let's test it. So here are, again, 3 roots, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. Out of them, you can construct an equation by looking at the product, x minus lambda 1 times x minus lambda 2 times x minus lambda 3, and you get 4 coefficients, A, B, C, and D, and in fact, A is stuck at 1, so it's not really there. And then you apply the next step of the machine, you get delta, the next step, the next step, the next step, and at the end, you get R, and R is pointing at one of the roots. In this case, it's lambda 3. So if I will start moving the input, say, so if I move lambda 1, then the coefficients will change, uppercase delta will change, lowercase delta will change, and so on, but by continuity, R does not change. However, if I move lambda 3, R will move in the correct way, which means that we've solved the cubic equation. Okay, so I'd like to make two comments. So this phenomena where the output R always follows one of the roots is provable. It's basically continuity. There is nothing hard about it. However, there are exceptions. Namely, if lambda 1 meets lambda 2, so if I will drag lambda 3 is the one that I'm following. So if I will drag lambda 3 to be on top of lambda 2, then the machine has no way of knowing which thing to follow. This actually corresponds to it corresponds to uppercase delta becoming zero, and when your input is zero, and then you exit away from zero, your memory doesn't tell you which way to exit, whether to exit. If you're looking at the square root of negative epsilon, then you don't know whether to take the answer with I or negative I. Okay. When you raise epsilon away from zero, so basically when lambda 3 will hit lambda 2, it might be lambda 3 is R is still following lambda 3, but if I will make them coincide, then R when stationary, because it is now following lambda 2. What have I done? Yeah, it's now follow. Sorry, something is buggy here, but I think you should have gone. The point is here. Okay. Next, here is the quartic equation. And again, it's given by a long, long, long sequence of things. But the point of this sequence is, given the coefficients A, B, C, D, and E, you form delta 0, delta 1, delta 2, U, and V, and all of these are polynomials in the coefficients. Or actually rational functions, I'm also allowing division. And then you take a square root and form new polynomials in the things you already have. And then you take another root and form new polynomials in the things you already have. And then you take another root and eventually you get the answer. And again, if you really want to know what this looks like, you execute it, and you don't really want to know what it looks like. And if you want to see how the machine works, so I move the inputs, everything moves around like crazy, and the output, which is here, moves correspondingly. Okay? And, we could test it in the same way as before. But I think you got the point, so I'm not sure why I should be wasting your time doing it. Okay? So let's move on to the theorem. No such machine made by composing polynomials and roots and polynomials and roots, rational functions, I'm also allowing divisions, will solve the quintic equation, the equation of degree 5. Okay? Are you with me? Still, more or less? Okay, so one further piece of background before going into the proof. So the persistent square root, so here's the tenth, so here is, maybe I should enlarge it again. So here is a number and its tenth root. And I'm computing the persistent 10th root. So basically, if I start from the number, let's roll it back. If I start from the number 1, the persistent square root will be 1, or the initial value is 1. If I roll around 0, the persistent 10th root rolled by a tenth of a rotation, so instead of being 1, it's 1 with argument, what is it, 2 pi over 10? Basically what I said before about the set of roots of a complex number. So in general, if I take a path in the input space, so even if I do a closed path, so if I make a path that starts at a point and comes back to the same point, the persistent root might not come back to the same point. However, it's very easy to figure out what the persistent root does. If the input winds around 0 k times, the persistent 10th root will move k clicks counterclockwise, or I mean in the direction of your rotation. Okay? So it's true that a closed path here might correspond to a not necessarily closed path in the output, but if you want to measure how much it is not closed, it is not closed by a measurement which is an integer. A certain number of clicks, which you clicked counterclockwise, which depends on how many rotations counterclockwise you made. But then there is a funny conclusion to it. So if a certain closed path in this place, in this input space, is the commutator of two paths, so you do one path, you do path A, then you do path B, then you do path A backwards, then you do path B backwards, then even if A and B do not become closed paths here, their commutator will be closed. Because if path A moves p clicks and path B corresponds to moving q clicks, then going backwards on A will move backwards p clicks, and going backwards on B will move backwards q clicks, and p plus q minus p minus q is equal to 0, as we have verified on at least one example before. Okay? So the persistent root of a closed path is not necessarily closed, but the persistent root of a commutator of two paths is always closed. And now we can give the proof. Here is the proof, the whole proof. All of it. That's it. Okay, let me enlarge it a bit and try to explain. Okay? How much time do I have?
Is it 10 minutes?
10 minutes? Yeah, that's too much.
We don't have pizza outside because we only have the room booked to 2 p.m.
Okay, so that's too much and we should do something else. And the problem is really easy. We should kill some time. Okay, let's do it anyway. So, suppose there was a closed formula for the fifth root, for the root of an equation of degree 5. So it really would correspond to a machine much like the machines we discussed before. So at the very left, you will have the complex plane, and in it, you will be marking 5 roots. These are sort of the roots that form the equations that we want to solve. So let's call them lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, lambda 4, lambda 5. Then you will look at x minus lambda 1 times x minus lambda 2 times x minus so on, and this will give you coefficients a, b, c, d, e, and f, also lying in the complex plane, and these are the coefficients of the equations that we want to solve. And I'm arguing that there isn't a machine that solves this equation. Namely, you cannot find a collection of polynomials, P1, and again, I really meant rational functions, so I really allow division as well. So you cannot find a collection P1 of polynomials, delta 0, delta 1, u, and what else did I put here? Just that. Okay? It's just an example. I'm claiming you cannot do it. So, okay? So you cannot find such polynomials that will move as you move these, and then so that you would be, and then you can, sorry, you cannot find the whole machine. So the next step would be taking the root of one of those numbers here, and then the next step would be applying polynomials to all the numbers you've had so far, and then the next step will be, well, basically you'll be alternating polynomials or rational functions and taking roots, and at the end you'll get an output which will be pointing at one of the roots here. No such machine, so this step of course exists, but no machine going from here to here exists. Why? Okay, so suppose there was such a machine, and furthermore, let's suppose it only had four steps of alternating roots and polynomials. Clearly, the proof will work equally well if it had six steps or 28 steps, but I'll do four because that's what fits on the block, on the board. Okay? So, no such machine with four steps exists. Why? So, choose paths, gamma 1, any paths, gamma 1 up to gamma 16, and since these are generation 1 paths, I will put superscript 1 on top of all of them. And these paths are, you should be thinking of them as musical chair paths. So basically, each of these paths looks like, so it's a path in the input space, in this space of collections of 5 roots. So the way these paths look like is lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3 get up from their, get out of their chair, dance around each other a little bit, and then sit down in a different order. Okay? Such a path in particular induces a permutation, right? Because you can follow and see, you know, if lambda 1 got up and sat in the position of lambda 4, it would be the permutation which maps 1 to 4. Okay? Secondly, you can compose such paths. So basically, if you had a path in which lambda 1 and lambda 2 got up, danced around, and sat in each other places, then composing it with another, composing it even with itself, would be, okay, now they get up again and do the same dance, so whoever is sitting in the position of lambda 1 will be doing the dance that lambda 1 did. Okay? So you can compose such paths. And then let's form the compositions. So the generation 2 compositions will be gamma 1 up 2 up to gamma 1 up 8. And you will make, they will be the commutators of pairs from among the 16 paths in generation 1. Then, in generation 3, you will take commutators of pairs of gamma 2s, and so on, until eventually you will get path a single path, gamma 5, gamma generation 5. And what it will be the commutator of the two paths you got in generation 4. So really, it will be the commutator of the commutator of the commutators of the commutators of the paths in generation 1. And I'm not sure I counted correctly the number of times that I said commutators of commutators of commutators. But it doesn't really matter. Now, what's the point? So in the first space, in the first block, none of these paths is necessarily closed. These paths were musical chair paths. Okay? They're not necessarily closed. So lambda 2 might swap place with lambda 1. Okay? If you push them to here, so you know, you move these around and you see how these move around, then here the motions will be closed. Things come back to where they were. Because of the commutative law for multiplication, I believe. Namely, how do you find these coefficients A, B, C, D, E, F out of the lambdas? Well, you just look at x minus lambda 1 times x minus lambda 2 times ta-ta-ta up to x minus lambda 5, and you write it as A x to the 5 plus B x to the 4 plus and so on. And if the lambdas move, maybe they trade places, but, sorry, at the end of the dance, maybe they trade places, but it's still the same collection of lambdas, so you still get the same product, so you still get the same polynomial here. Okay? So, if you push the paths to here, they are closed. If you push them further to here, they are still closed, because applying a polynomial, there is no ambiguity in a polynomial. You don't need any persistence, you don't need any memory, you don't need civil servants to tell you what to do. Okay? However, once you push these paths to here, they may all open. More precisely, the paths of generation 1 may open here. However, the paths in generation 2, the lambda, the paths with up 2 in them, they are commutator of paths of generation 1. So they remain closed. So over here, paths of generation 2 are still closed. You apply a polynomial, you get a collection of closed paths. You apply a root, they may open, but the paths in generation 3 are still closed. And when you keep going, you find that at the very end, the path of generation 5 is closed. But that's nonsense, because I could have chosen the paths to implement the permutations that I was showing on one of the first slides, those 16 permutations whose commutators of commutators of commutators make a non-trivial permutation. Had I chosen my paths to be these, then gamma 5, where is gamma 5? Gamma 5 would be an extremely intricate dance of these things. Long, long, long dance, but it would be a dance that takes lambda 1 to lambda 2. Okay? It would be a non-trivial dance. And if R is always pointing at lambda 1, then, actually, it's always pointing at lambda 2. Sorry, so let's pretend I took the a collection of permutations whose commutators of commutators of commutators map lambda 2 to lambda 3. Now, if R is always pointing where lambda 2 is pointing, then R should move to here at the end of the complicated dance, and that's not a closed path. Contradiction. Theorem is proven. You don't need to take algebra anymore. maybe something about strengths and weaknesses of this proof. So it is stronger than the usual statement because, in fact, it works not just for square roots and the four basic operations. I have proven to you that you cannot solve the quintic equation using exponentials, sines, logarithms, the Riemann zeta function, basically any function that you can, well, the conditions can be stated, analytic of certain types, but basically any reasonable function will not help you solve the quintic equation. Any reasonable univalued function. However, it's also weaker than the standard proof because the standard proof will tell you that some specific equations, for example this one, cannot be solved as a specific equation, not just that there isn't a general formula, but even this particular equation cannot be, you cannot find the answer in terms of square roots and nth roots and rational numbers. So that I cannot show you. Okay. Sorry for wasting your time.
No, yes. That's fine. Thank you so much. We have to clear the room, like basically now. So we're going to take a pizza outside. We're going to eat outside. But before we do that, let's thank the professor.